The third case for oral argument this morning is Charles Wilson Appellant versus Raisin Weber, Inc., doing business as Olson Painting Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Chet Grossclose, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Ms. Christy Gessler-Holm, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, former justice of this court, to sit in Justice Meyer Henry's place. Mr. Grossclose, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I represent Charles Wilson, Chuck Wilson. He's now 44 years of age. He was 39 at the time of his work-related injury on April 1, 2004. He was injured while working for Scott Raisin Weber, who does business as Olson Painting and Wallpaper Covering, and that's one of the respondents in this case. Chuck Wilson was a painter and wallpaper hanger. He'd done most of that. He'd done that mostly throughout his adult life, and in this job he was working doing that kind of work for both commercial and residential work. It seems important to the employer and insurer that for most of Chuck Wilson's adult life, he was a practicing alcoholic. He got into some trouble while he was a practicing alcoholic. He pled guilty to multiple DWIs, and he served 2 years in the state penitentiary. But Chuck Wilson has turned his life around, and we think that's more important than what happened to him in the past. He's been able to keep his alcoholism in remission for 6 years, or it was 6 years at the time of the hearing, and he's continued to work regularly in spite of having some disability and some pain resulting from this injury. As far as Chuck Wilson's work record, he was regarded by his employer, Raisin Weber, as a decent employee, at least until he got this injury on April 1, 2004. This is a case about credibility. It's about the credibility of three people: Chuck Wilson, Scott Raisin Weber, and a co-employee, Mike Newton. The facts, very briefly, are that on April 1, 2004, Chuck Wilson rode with Mike Newton. He was picked up by Mike Newton in his little Datsun pickup. And I mentioned the fact that it's little because Chuck Wilson is 6'2" and weighs 240 pounds, so it was some involvement getting in and out of the pickup. They got picked up, or he got picked up at a convenience store near his apartment, and they rode from there to Raisin Weber's shop. When they got to Raisin Weber's shop, Chuck leaned into the back of the pickup to get his tool bag. He leaned forward, and there was a topper on the pickup, so he had to lean forward, and his back was then a fulcrum. As he leaned forward, he picked up his tool bag, backed up, set it down, took it out of the pickup, and set it down. He said he had kind of a weird feeling at that time. He called it a twinge, but he didn't think it was disabling, and it wasn't particularly painful. He continued to load the pickup with supplies that they needed. When the pickup was loaded, they drove to Bakke's house. He was asked before they drove to Bakke's house — Bakke is the homeowner whose house was being painted — before they drove to the Bakke house, Chuck Wilson said in a later conversation with the insurance adjuster that he was okay at this point. When they got to the Bakke house, Chuck Wilson had a very, very difficult time getting out of the pickup. Bakke saw him. He was looking at him out the window, and he saw that he had expressions of pain on his face, and he had difficulty getting out of the pickup. When he got out of the pickup, he tried to carry some paint up the walkway. And as he did that, Bakke said he grimaced. When he got the paint up to the Bakke house, Chuck realized, in his words, that he was going to be useless on the job site. So he called Richard Duncan, a supervisor with the employer, and got a ride home. Duncan, in giving him a ride home, could tell by looking at his face that he was in a lot of pain. He noticed that when he hit bumps, he aggravated the pain, so he said he drove very, very carefully. Something that also speaks about Chuck Wilson's work ethic is when he went home that day, he hung around his apartment. He was uncomfortable throughout the day, but the next morning he wanted to go back to work. He said he needed the work, he needed the money, and even though he felt a little gingerly, he met Mike Newton to get a ride to work again. And Newton said, "Are you going to be able to work?" And he said, "I don't know. Well, we'll see." So when they got over to the Bakke house, the pain had recurred, and he wasn't able to work. He called Richard Duncan again and got a ride home. That was the last day he attempted to work for Reisenweber. The administrative law judge entered a finding proposed by the employer and insurer that Chuck Wilson completed a first report of injury a week after the accident, and in that first report of injury, he indicates that this injury occurred at the Bakke house after they left the shop and went over to the Bakke house. About a week and a half later, after he gives that statement, he's interviewed by an insurance adjuster, and there's a transcript of that interview that's part of the record, and it's Exhibit 7 in this record. And in that interview, Chuck Wilson says, "Come to think of it, my back felt like it was a little sore, kind of moving my tool bag out of the pickup and then loading the paint. It felt kind of weird, but it didn't feel like it was out or nothing." And he later, in that same conversation, said the problem arose when he got to the Bakke house. So here we have him giving one representation of what, where he thinks the accident happened in the first report of injury. In a later conversation with the insurance adjuster, and thinking back about it, he remembers he has this weird feeling, and he thinks maybe that's when the whole thing arose. But the administrative law judge entered 11 findings in which he reached the conclusion that Chuck Wilson was not credible. He was lying. He changed his mind about where the injury occurred, and therefore he was denied compensation. So because of the uncertainty that as to what precipitated this disability, and we think that's a fairly sophisticated medical question, Chuck Wilson's workers' compensation claim was denied on the basis that he deliberately lied. An interesting thing that raises the legal issues here is that both of the documents in which record the alleged deliberate change of story are written documents that we think are subject to a de novo review by the court.
Is that what you're basing your case then on, because of the credibility ruling?
That credibility ruling, and there are two other credibility rulings, Your Honor.
But the credibility ruling on veracity goes against your client, so what you're saying is that your client's case should prevail anyway based on these documents?
Yes, I'm saying that there's a, by de novo review, you review those documents, and a de novo review will indicate that he wasn't deliberately lying. He was talking about a sophisticated medical question for which he had no training. He was honest, he was consistent throughout all the statements and his testimony in this case. But there's another credibility issue, too, Your Honor, and that is the credibility of Reisenweber. Reisenweber gave a statement 1 week after the injury, after Chuck Wilson's injury, and in that statement he said that he said many things, most of which he recanted when he testified at the workers' compensation trial 23 months later. So the question arises, is he credible when he gave the statement 1 week after the injury occurred, or is he credible at the workers' compensation trial? He can't be credible both times. The two the incidents of his testimony are mutually exclusive.
Mr. Grosskloss, Reisenweber was cross-examined on this.
Was cross-examined?
On this point of inconsistency.
Yes, he was, Your Honor.
So why should we change the rules and not defer to the fact finder? The fact finder heard the cross on the alleged inconsistency and made a decision. Why are we permitted to go beyond what that fact finder decided? Because the fact finder heard the cross on this point.
Well, I think there are two reasons, Your Honor. One of them is that the statement that he gave is documentary evidence. It can be examined by you in a de novo review. That's one reason, and you can compare it with his testimony. The other reason is that in the Ballmer case, as I understand it, this court said that when a determined that usually credibility is a factual question, but when an administrative law judge enters a finding discrediting the testimony of a claimant, but does so without reconciling that finding with the record, finding support in the record, then the court does not have to defer to that finding. And in the Ballmer case, the court held that administrative law judge committed or was guilty of, or the determination was erroneous, the factual basis for making a determination in spite of or notwithstanding the de novo review. So I think there's two reasons there why Reisenweber's testimony should be discredited. There are three reasons or three things that Reisenweber said in his testimony that he recanted in his live testimony. Three things that he said in his statement that he recanted in his testimony. One of them is, and we should talk a little bit about the report that he prepared. He prepared this report to go to his insurance company. He prepared it 1 week to the day after Chuck Wilson's injury. He said that the purpose of preparing that report was to call to his insurance company concerns they had about Chuck Wilson's claim. And he wanted to report the facts as he knew them. He knew that the report should be accurate. He knew that it should be complete. And before he prepared that report, he interviewed both Bakke and Newton. And then he told his wife exactly, in his term, what happened on Monday of that week, on Tuesday of that week, on Wednesday of that week, and on Thursday of that week. And she typed the report. Reisenweber testified that he thought the report was accurate and complete. His conclusion to the report indicates his satisfaction with it. He says, "Should there be anything else you need from us, please don't hesitate to call." Then he signed the report. He says he didn't read it before he signed it, but he signed it. The one contradiction there is that he testified at the hearing, and this came up for the first time, that Wilson was Wilson told him that he was injured on Monday and Tuesday of the week that he was injured, that he had a sore back, and that he was injured over the weekend. But he didn't report anything like that. Reisenweber didn't report that in Exhibit or Appendix 1, the report. He not only failed to report it, but he reported just the opposite. He reported that Chuck Wilson had no complaints, no pain on Monday, and on Tuesday he had no complaints, no pain. There are two other inconsistencies between his report, glaring inconsistencies between his report, and I'm not sure that I'll have time to cover all of those. One of them is that Wilson, when he called and asked for a ride home the morning of his injury, he first called Reisenweber and asked for a ride home. He did not say, and he did not say at any other time, this is according to the employer and insurer, and a finding was made to this effect, he did not say that he hurt his back at work. He merely said he had a sore back and he wanted to go home. That's what the administrative law judge found. However, in Appendix 1, the report prepared by Reisenweber, he reported that Chuck Wilson said he hurt his back working at the client's home. And then later he said in Appendix 1, the claim reflects that Wilson suffered an injury at the job site. And just as damaging, or maybe more damaging, to Wilson's credibility is the fact that there was an answer filed to the petition for hearing, filed on his behalf, that says, on April 1, 2004, claimant reported to employer and claimed to have that he claimed to have been injured his back arising out of and in the course of his employment on that day. And then there's the third indication of his recanting his report. He said that he was told before he prepared the report that Mike Newton had observed Chuck Wilson limping when he got into the pickup that morning. The implication being, of course, that he was injured before he got to work. That's another, that there is no mention made of that in that report. And of course, that's dynamite information if it were true that he would want to include in the report to alert the insurer his concerns about the validity of Chuck Wilson's claims. He didn't include that in the report. In fact, he states two times in that report that he was told that Chuck Wilson was injured at Bakke's house. This court said in the Vollmer case, and I talked about this a minute ago, that when the ALJ discredits a claimant's testimony without providing a factual explanation supported by the record, the court will not defer to that finding. And in the Vollmer case, as we mentioned earlier, the court held that ALJ Bingner's finding that Mrs. Vollmer was not credible was clearly erroneous. So there are two bases for determining each one of these sets of findings on the three credibility issues are not or should be overturned, and the case decided in favor of Chuck Wilson. Mike Newton is an interesting study. He gave three statements before he got to the workers' compensation trial. One of them was a recorded interview that was done in July of 2004, about 3 months afterwards. If you read that statement carefully, it's clear that Mike Newton is talking about the events that occurred on Friday, April 2nd, and only the events of Friday, April 2nd, and not the events of Thursday, April 1st. He was talking about the next day, which had a lot of similarity. Then we prepared a typewritten statement, which we sent to Newton, and sent him a highlighted copy of his transcribed interview, the one that I've just made reference to, and that's Appendix 2 in the record. And he in this statement that he signed outside of our presence and dated October 24, 2004, he says just what we concluded and what we think is the only conclusion you can reach from that statement, and that is that he was talking about Friday, April 2, and not about April 1.
Thank you, Mr. Grossholz. Ms. Giesler-Holm, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, good morning. I understand, Justice Sabers, that this is your final argument that I just learned right before we started, so I do join others, even though I expressed this last week at your celebration, I join the others that have said it today, and thank you for your service to the state of South Dakota. We do appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, but I hate to correct you because I'm going to sit in until my replacement comes along, which could be, so there might be a couple people at least in this crowd who made a premature trip.
Okay, yes, I was going to say, I thought I had inside information there from members of the courtroom.
We have an encore in the works.
Anyway, the issue presented today is not a complicated one. This is a really simple, straightforward issue. The only issue presented to the hearing examiner in this bifurcated case was, did you believe the claimant got hurt at work like he claimed? That was the only issue. As Mr. Grossholz acknowledged, that issue is entirely based on credibility. This is a factual issue. This court has recognized over and over that issues of credibility are factual. As a factual issue, it is subject to a clearly erroneous standard of review. In this case, there were 8 witnesses who testified over a period of 8.5 hours. That was their credibility. That is what the ALJ based his decision on, was listening to these 8 witnesses testify for that period of time. This court has recognized that when the trial court is presented with conflicts in the evidence that the hearing examiner has to resolve, this court, it is not this court's job to change those resolutions of the conflicts. No doubt, there were conflicts here. We had 2 different stories presented by the parties. But the ALJ heard the testimony, he saw the witnesses, he heard them testify about the exhibits, and he made the determination based on the credibility that he did not believe the claimant. He did not believe that he was hurt at work as he claimed he was. He believed he was hurt before he even came to work that day, adopting the testimony of one of the other witnesses. Now, under a clearly erroneous standard, deference and great weight are owed to the hearing examiner because he was the one that was there to hear the witnesses, to see them, to watch how they reacted, to see what they did when they were presented with these exhibits that we've heard Mr. Grossholz discuss. He got to see that. He got to evaluate that, and he got to make a decision. Unless this court has a definite and firm conviction that a mistake was made by the ALJ, this case should not be reversed.
What was the testimony that he hurt himself any other time than prior to taking the tools out of the truck or when he felt it when he got out of the truck and went to the Bakke job site?
To clarify, Mr. Grossholz has repeatedly throughout this case tried to keep the focus on the dispute being whether he got hurt one time at work or another time at work. The critical evidence here and the evidence adopted by both the ALJ and the circuit court, Judge Lieberman, was that he was hurt before he even came to work. Mike Newton, the witness who the ALJ, Judge Binger, recognized was the key witness, the key independent witness who had nothing to gain by this testimony, came in and testified consistently and without question that he was hurt when he came to pick him up on Thursday morning, April 1st. He was already coming out limping. He emphasized that, and again, consistently, that the same thing happened again on Friday. So based on Mr. Newton's testimony, which the ALJ undoubtedly through his 8-plus-page written decision and in his findings of fact said, This was a key piece of information. I believed this guy. He was credible. He was the most credible witness. He is the one who said he was hurt before he even started working that day. So this is not a case where the dispute is, did he get hurt at work one place or the other? While that does come into play because of credibility issues for the claimant, that's not what the true dispute is. The true dispute is, was he hurt before he even came to work that day, or did he get hurt at work that day as he claims? The ALJ resolved that in employer and insurer's favor based in large part on the testimony of Mr. Newton that he was hurt before he even came to work that day. And again, that decision, while you don't owe deference, Judge Lieberman on appeal to the circuit court agreed with that finding. Mr. Grossclose, in an effort to try to change the standard of review here from what is very clearly a clearly erroneous standard of review on credibility determinations, tries to argue that this court should have de novo review because of documentary evidence. Now, if you review the cases on documentary evidence, what this court is talking about is the understanding that if there is documentary evidence, you are in the same position as the trial court would be to review the evidence and make the same decision. If you review those cases, those are cases of medical records, medical depositions, other depositions, things where the testimony is the document itself. Here, the testimony was live. There were live witnesses, 8 people testifying. This documentary evidence that Mr. Grossclose continues to point to is nothing more than exhibits that were used at the hearing. Everything that he pointed out today is exactly what was presented at the hearing. The witnesses testified. You know, did they have these so-called statements put in front of them? Yes, they were an exhibit at the hearing. The witnesses then got to explain what they meant by them, why they did what they did, why they said what they did. The hearing examiner got to hear that, see how they reacted, saw their demeanor, if they were fidgeting, if they seemed like they were lying. To say that you're in the same position as them and able to review those documents as documentary evidence de novo is not correct. Here, you don't have that same ability because you don't have the live witnesses in front of you to see how they react when they're explaining that testimony. Hearing exhibit number 10, which I believe is in Appendix 2, is a prime example of that. That's the statement, as Mr. Grossclose keeps referring to it, of Mike Newton. I would first point out that even though these keep being labeled as a statement, these are not affidavits. These are not sworn under oath. This is a piece of paper that Mr. Grossclose presented to Mr. Newton to sign. Now, at the hearing, Mr. Newton came. He was asked about this. Mr. Grossclose presented it to him and asked him, well, you told me that you were making all this up and confusing dates, and you signed this statement. Mr. Newton was able to explain to the hearing examiner that he lied in this. He wasn't under oath. He had no obligation. In fact, he went so far as to say he signed it simply to get Mr. Grossclose to leave. That's the type of testimony that cannot be reviewed de novo because you were not there to see him, to hear what he had to say, to see how he reacted. The evidence here all came from live witnesses. It was their credibility that the hearing examiner looked at, and it was based on that evaluation of the credibility that the hearing examiner made the decision. Even the cases cited by Mr. Grossclose confirm that what is meant by documentary evidence are things like medical depositions, stipulated medical records, where the document itself is the testimony, and you can review that yourself just the same as the hearing examiner could. That is not what we have in this case. This court does sit in a different position than the hearing examiner did. The basics of this case, as I've already pointed out, we have a fight in the evidence. We have 2 different stories presented. The claimant said that he got hurt moving a tool belt in the back of a pickup. The employer and insurer's witnesses said, no, you were hurt before you ever came to work that day. 8 witnesses, 8.5 hours of testimony. The hearing examiner issued a 9-page decision analyzing the testimony. This is not a case where there's a short paragraph saying, I heard evidence and I accept the employer and insurer's position. The hearing examiner here went through detail, comparing and contrasting the statements and testimony of the witnesses, going through each of these exhibits that Mr. Grossclose has pointed out, including this statement of Exhibit number 4, the statement of Mr. Reisenweber, which again is no statement. It's simply a letter written to the insurance company. It's not a sworn statement under oath, a deposition, anything like that. But the hearing examiner in these 9 pages went through in detail, compared and contrasted the testimony, made explicit findings on who he believed, why he believed them, where he found conflicts. Even with Mr. Newton, this person he recognized as a key witness, he went through and said, I realize he has some inconsistencies. He specifically found that in his written memorandum decision. But then he said, but these are inconsistencies that do not matter. These are minor things. The main issue that I accept and the one that Mr. Newton has testified to consistently is that when he picked up the claimant for work 2 consecutive days in a row, he already appeared hurt. He was hurt before he ever went to work that day. In all likelihood, he got hurt on the side job the day before. But that was the testimony that the hearing examiner recognized, even though he did recognize there were some inconsistencies in it. And if you review the hearing examiner's decision, you will see that he went through witness by witness, testimony by testimony, comparing, contrasting each of these to make the decision. Now, Mr. Grossclos continues to point to the Vollmer case as being a basis to reverse on credibility. First of all, to the extent that case had documentary evidence forming the basis of any credibility determination, it again was based on medical records and depositions and affidavits that the court looked at to see how it impacted credibility. What is more important in Vollmer, however, is that the reason for reversal was that you found the ALJ failed to explain the inconsistencies. The decision there was, I don't believe the claimant because the testimony of the claimant doesn't match the surveillance. There was no explanation there, from what I understand in reading the decision, as to what the reasons were for why they didn't believe. What did they see in the surveillance that was inconsistent? They did not go through that reasoning. Judge Binger, in this case, did. He went through it in great detail and explained, compared, contrast, very carefully went through it all. Now, I don't think this court expects a hearing examiner to reconcile and explain each and every sentence in testimony, each and every sentence of an exhibit. Mr. Grossclos has pointed to perhaps 2 things that he thinks should have been clarified more. That's not what is required. In the end, when you review Judge Banger's decision, you know where he's coming from. You can see where his reasoning was. You can understand why he reached the decision he reached. And that is the reason that this court should defer to that finding, because it's based on credibility, and it's what we have recognized in the state of South Dakota, and this court has repeatedly held to, that credibility is for the fact finder. There is no way in reviewing that decision that you can be left wondering why he came up with that decision, why he found in favor of the employer and insurer. Even, again, Judge Lieberman, while you don't have to defer to him, he reviewed the same evidence and went so far as to say that, frankly, he thought the claimant had no credibility after reading through the transcript and the evidence. And while he recognized that wasn't the standard, he understood why Judge Binger got to the decision that he got to. This case was decided on credibility, and reviewing that evidence and the department's decision, there are clearly reasons to support each finding that was made, and the determination in favor of employer and insurer was not clearly erroneous. Now, further demonstrating just how strongly the ALJ felt about claimant's case lacking any merit and the claimant lacking credibility is the fact that costs were awarded to employer and insurer. That's another issue on appeal here. The award of costs are subject to an abuse of discretion standard. And as this court just recently defined in Kurtz v. Squires, abuse of discretion is a fundamental error of judgment, a choice outside the range of permissible choices, a decision which on full consideration is arbitrary or unreasonable. Here, the award was clearly permissible. It's allowed under law. Does it happen often? No. I don't believe it does happen often that employers and insurers are awarded costs against a claimant. But what is significant about that is it is permissible, it's not unreasonable, and it goes to demonstrate just how strongly this administrative law judge felt that this claimant had no credibility, had no business bringing this case. He did not believe this case had any merit. And to put the dot on the I, he awarded costs against him.
What was the case you cited on that issue?
Kurtz v. Squires, and the site I have is 2008 SD-101.
Thank you.
In conclusion, we do not believe the claimant sustained his burden of proof here. The ALJ agreed. He made explicit findings on that issue. It is a credibility determination. We would ask that this court recognize that the standard of review here is clearly erroneous and not apply a de novo standard of review as suggested by the appellant. Further, the award of costs was reasonable, and we would therefore ask that this court affirm on all grounds. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Giesler-Holm. Mr. Gross-Colson.
Pardon me. Did you cite the Kirby Squares?
No, that case actually just came out, I believe, last week.
Great.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gross-Colson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We were talking about Newton's statements, and Ms. Holm made a statement that I think needs to be corrected. In the first place, a careful reading of the transcript of Mike Newton's interview given 3 months after the injury admits to only one conclusion. That is, he's talking about April 2nd. He's not talking about April 1st. He said when he testified that he was talking about both days. He wasn't. When you read that statement, he's mistaken. His testimony is characterized by forgetfulness and by confusion. For example, he's asked by Ms. Holm at the testimony, do you know what day, or was April 1 on Thursday? He said, I don't know. She said, well, you assume for me that April 1 was on Thursday? And he said, yes. So he assumed that in the rest of his testimony. There are numerous inconsistencies and confusion in his testimony. While Reisenweber has motives, we don't claim that Newton has motives, or if he does, we don't know what they are. He gave 3 statements. He didn't give 2. I was talking about the 2 statements, or the 2 statements subsequent to his recorded interview. One of them was a typewritten statement that I mailed to him that I sent to him. I don't know if I mailed it or how I got it to him. He acknowledges that. He signed that one in 2004, in October of 2004, the same year as the injury. That's the one in which he says the same thing that we've been saying, the same thing that we've challenged the employer and insurer to disprove, and they haven't attempted to disprove, and that is that the recorded interview talks about the second day. It doesn't talk about the first day. He's confused. He indicates there that the insurer was confused in taking the statement. Now, there is a third statement, and this is the one that I wrote out and signed, and he signed while I was in his home, the only time I was in his home. And that statement is one sentence. It says, when I picked Chuck up the first day, April 1, he was moving and walking normally until we got to the Bakke house. That's the one that Ms. Holmes says he said he signed to get me out of the house. He did say that. That was the fourth time he was asked the question, why did you sign this? He said to get him out of the house. He also said the first time he said it was stupid. And the second one was, I don't know. And the third one was, did he, me, force you to sign it? And he said, him? No, he didn't force me to sign it. He goes on to say several times that I told him and Chuck Wilson told him that we only wanted him to tell the truth. And he said he did tell the truth. He testified that he did tell the truth. And he said that we didn't put any pressure on him. He was asked by Ms. Holm at one point, did we put any pressure on him to change his statements? And he said, no. And then she said, did they attempt to have you change your statements? And he said, no. So then we got to his hearing testimony, and he says that he gave 4 or 5 statements, and they were, quote, all exactly the same. And another time he says he gave 3 statements, and they are all exactly the same. And they are all exactly the same. But that's inconsistent with the testimony that he gave, that he was talking about April 1 rather than April 2 in the first interview. And he says that in that first interview that was recorded and transcribed, that interview or that statement was just like every other statement. And then finally, he's talking to Ms. Holm, answering a question, and he said, I don't know why I give these statements. If you don't believe me, why the hell do I give them? So he's again insisting that these statements, which they have disparaged, are not true. The important thing is that those 3 statements are absolutely consistent with each other. They're absolutely consistent with the recorded interview by Chuck Wilson, or of Chuck Wilson, and with Chuck Wilson's live testimony. They're absolutely consistent with the Reisenweber statement that he prepared for his insurance company, and they're consistent with all of the other testimony. Ms. Holm talks about the other witnesses. They don't have anything to say about these credibility issues, but the 3 statements are consistent with what Chuck Wilson says on 2 different occasions and on what Reisenweber says initially before he recanted what he said the first time. We want to emphasize the point that there's no way that a reading of the transcribed interview with Mike Newton in July of 2004 will substantiate their claim and what he said at his, in a kind of a confused and forgetful manner, what he said at his hearing testimony, and that is that he was talking about both days. A clear reading of that will tell you that he's talking about Friday, April 2nd. He's not talking about Thursday, April 1. So he was not consistent. The administrative law judge finds that he's consistent. You can review the written documents, and they can be done, you can do a de novo review of those. But I don't think, in view of Vollmer, that you should, as maybe suggested by Ms. Holm, ignore the testimony. The testimony needs to be reconciled with the findings made by the administrative law judge. Many of those findings, he attempts no explanation. They're absolutely in conflict with the documentary evidence in this case, and they are not supported by the record. So there are 2 bases for reversal in this case, and the one that we ask you to take is the more difficult one, the more involved one. This case, I agree with Ms. Holm on one thing. This case starts out as a very simple case. And it reminds me of the saying that sometimes things are as simple as they seem. And after the de novo review and after getting rid of the elaborate statements that the insurer and employer and administrative law judge find, this is a simple case. He was a big man. His back was a fulcrum when he was lifting. he suffered an injury. That's not uncommon. That happens frequently at work. That's a typical workers' compensation case. What happened here that's different is that the employer decided because he said he was working at the Bakke house, the employer said, well, he wasn't doing any work at the Bakke house. The employer had the idea that he had to have been painting or hanging wallpaper or something like that. He ignored the concept that if he was on the job and when he was injured, he's entitled to a workers' compensation. So the employer said, well, we're going to get this guy because he wasn't working at the Bakke house. Well, if he'd have known all the things that he says he knew at the hearing, he could have gotten him by showing that he was injured before, or he could have at least alerted the insurance company to that by showing that he was injured. So, Your Honors, we think that a review of this case in light of Vollmer and a de novo review of the documentary evidence will make this case as simple as it seems and as it should be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grossclaws. Today is a monumental day for the South Dakota Supreme Court, and in some respects a sad day, because this is the final time that our good friend and colleague Justice Sabers will sit with us as a regular justice of this court. He has served this court for 23 years in what I call the modern era, that is the unified judicial system that came into effect in 1975. This length of service is without peer. And it's not just the length of his service, but also the quality of his service that makes him special and so dear to the rest of us on this court. He approached every case as the most important. He always went the extra mile on it and gave it his full attention. This court is better for his service. This state is better for his service. So, on behalf of the South Dakota Supreme Court, and maybe more importantly, on behalf of the people of the state of South Dakota, thank you, Richard Sabers, for your 23 years of exceptional service to the people of this state.
You're welcome.
All I've got to say is we've got to stop meeting like this.
Now, I guess court is in recess.
You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com.